Hello and welcome to episode 37. See, I screwed up. I shouldn't have stopped because I can cut you out. Hello and welcome to episode 37 of the Spread Aviation Podcast. I'm Rob.
I'm Matt.
You're just screwing with me now. That was intentional. I know it was.
Yep. No, we don't have any 56K modems or anything like that going on. That'd be pretty funny if we did.
Wow. Yeah.
Can you imagine?
Make me insert the old dial-up sounds into here.
Insert old dial-up sound. Can you imagine if we had to record these from afar on a 56K connection? You'd be saying something and I would reply like 10 or 15 seconds later. Actually, I don't even know. I mean, I remember back then you used to have the like voice to phone or internet phone thing. So I guess it kind of worked, but it was really bad.
Yeah, we'd have to have some kind of microphone set up on a handset phone speaker that was already, you know, another line. Because you could do that in a house. You could just pull all the phones off the hook while you were talking and record on whatever you wanted.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, wait, it was NetMeeting. Remember NetMeeting back in the day?
No, I don't.
Oh. If you remember NetMeeting, send us an email. NetMeeting was...
Hello, spreadaviation.com.
Yeah. That meeting was awesome.
Well, we might as well start off with the contact stuff. We always end with it, and by that time, I think nobody's listening anyway, so maybe we should start with it.
Go for it.
Hey, give us a follow on Instagram, YouTube, Facebook. Don't worry about Twitter. Check out our website, spreadaviation.com, and if you have any questions, comments, concerns, send those along to hello@spreadaviation.com. Matt, did I get them all?
You got them, and I mean, it's probably worth mentioning that we have recently decided to focus, you know, because you and I are only two people, and we've been recently decided to focus on the platforms that are getting us the most engagement, both because obviously we want to focus our time where it makes the most sense, and two is we want to reach as many people as possible and be able to answer people's questions, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, we're focusing on LinkedIn, Twitch, Facebook, and Instagram, and YouTube, and we have retired our Twitter presence. You know, we've still got the account, but, you know, it's just not worth putting the effort right now. So yeah, follow us on Instagram. That's where you'll get, the most, communication from us and with us. Sign up for our mailing list on our website. Check out YouTube, and Rob's live stream on Monday nights on Twitch,
twitch.tv/spreadaviation.
Yep. And we've got Facebook, but again, like we have that cause we have to, I think.
Yeah. I mean, Facebook's pretty crucial, pretty vital.
Yep.
It's not just cat memes anymore. A simpler time, really, though.
Indeed. So today, Rob, we're going to keep things super hyper-focused, and the entire podcast is going to be just about landing gear.
Okay, so I should put my phone down and stop checking Facebook?
Yeah.
Okay. No, but landing gear. Well, yeah, landing gear are important, and from the earliest days of aviation, we had to have landing gear, but... it didn't really take the shape of what we're used to nowadays. Do you know what kind of landing gear the Wright Flyer had on it?
I didn't, but let's start there.
Yeah, it was skis or skids. They didn't have wheels on them that they were necessarily landing on, so they were just designed to land in the sand.
Interesting. Now, with the resistance of those skids against the sand... require more thrust from the engine to move forward? Like, how does that all work with the relative wind, et cetera? Like, you know, trying to get off the ground and having skids going across sand, and there's probably got to be some drag there, no? Or I don't know if that's the right word.
Oh, there's a ton of drag there.
Yeah.
But the Wright brothers had an ingenious system of getting over this drag. They didn't have the skids on the sand. They had the Wright Flyer on a catapult.
Oh.
They were actually launching themselves into the air. So it wasn't like nowadays where, you know, we're rolling down the runway or anything like that. It's more like naval aviation where you're propelled by something else. Because the engines that they had back then weren't the most powerful. I mean, they had to sacrifice weight as much as possible. And you couldn't have, you know, 150 horsepower. It just wasn't going to happen. So they had a four-cylinder 12 horsepower engine powering two propellers with a chain drive. 12 horsepower.
Wow.
That's nuts.
that's insane. Now, Rob, before we get too far into this, I am going to say that I am banning any potential discussion about wheels on a treadmill or wheels or skids on a river. That there's just we're not even going there in this episode. So
it's just about gear.
Just well, I mean, no, not, treadmills. Not necessarily about gear. It's all different types of gear because there's tricycle gear, there's tailwheel, there's the floats on a seaplane, there's the skids on the Wright Flyer. But I kind of just asked you about how, you know, drag kind of interacted with the sand on the Wright Flyer.
And I stopped getting hyper-focused?
No. But I could have easily seen this conversation going into, well, like, if you have wheels on a treadmill or if you have floats on a river kind of thing, and that would probably turn this episode into a three-hour conversation because everybody knows about that debate. So,
and if you want a three-hour conversation as the Spread Aviation Podcast, send us an email, hello at spreadaviation.com.
So right, all right, the Wright Flyer skids early on. That's awesome. Like, what were the first wheels on an aircraft? Or did the seaplane stuff come first, the floats? Like, what?
There was a very interesting period, actually, where the seaplane was the major development area. And so you mainly had pontoons. And that was pushed really by racing and commercial aviation. So trying to get from point A to point B, the transatlantic side of things, you had flying boats. There was an entire age of flying boats. And you would take off out of New York, take off out of the East River or the Hudson or whatever, and then fly up to Nova Scotia, Greenland, Iceland, and then over to the British Isles. But water was the main thing you were flying over, so wheels weren't going to be that important. Around the end of the 1930s, into the 1940s, World War II, you transitioned out of the float planes and the amphibious aircraft into more land-based, but the first types of landing gear were conventional gear, and they got that name because they were first, and that's tailwheel. And we know it today as tailwheel, but back then they didn't necessarily use tailwheels; they used tail skids. So it was just a little draggy piece that cut grooves through the ground. I don't know how else to describe it, but it provided braking and a marginal amount of steering, and that was mainly your World War II aircraft. So you basically took it to the end of the big old field that you were operating out of in your aerodrome, pointed it into the wind, started up the engine, and some of these early ones, they didn't have throttles. They were just wide open throttle, so full power, and you controlled the amount of power you were getting with a blip switch. So you actually cut the ignition. So these guys would get pushed out to the end of the field. Some guy would grab the propeller and yell, clear prop, and he'd throw the propeller, and that would start the engine, and the pilot would be trying to keep it running, and then when everybody got out of the way, he'd just let go of the blip switch and take off. But this was an era where you were losing a lot of aircraft because they were narrow-track gear, high center of gravity, marginal steering abilities. And if you didn't come down, you know, perfectly straight or into the wind or with any kind of side load, you were going for a ride. So,
oh, wow.
You know, that's really how it started, is the tricycle gear. And there was an advantage there. I'm sorry, not the tricycle, the tailwheel, the conventional gear. And there was an advantage in that with geometry as well. So we talked about the Wright brothers having a horsepower and a weight issue. To get power out of these World War I engines, they were only like 100 horsepower, 120 horsepower. And in order to harness all of that to get to the performance, you had to have a massive propeller on them. Well, massive propeller means you have to either have really tall landing gear to not hit the ground with the propeller, or you angle the entire plane. So the conventional gear really had its uses up until engines got smaller, more powerful, more reliable, and materials improved. And that would be we're talking now 1950s into the 60s, the tricycle gear became a little more dominant in the industry. And there's a variety of reasons for that as well.
The skids on the tailwheel still exist today, though, right, on some aircraft?
I see it sometimes, right? They're really on antique aircraft. You're not going to see anything new manufactured with a tail skid. However, the parking brake on a long easy or a very easy or a quick easy is that they collapse the nose wheel, and then it just sits on the nose of the aircraft, and that's your parking brake. So that's not quite the same. It's not like you're using that for braking action.
And we've got that interview on YouTube from our experience at Oshkosh that kind of describes that.
Yeah. You can rent those.
Similar type of aircraft, right?
Oh, yeah. It's all the same designer, and it's all the same basic premise.
So, all right. So we've got the different types of wheels. Now, you know, let's talk about the types of tires. So, you know, there was always the whole kick in the tire thing, right? Kick the tires and go. And, you know, obviously as part of our pre-flight, you know, we're always checking the tires. So, you know, how about a reminder of what to look for in gear when you're doing your pre-flight?
Well, I don't think I ever officially instructed you to kick any tires.
But if you did kick one and it was really, really squishy.
That's
the whole phrase of people say kick the tires and go, which is what you should not do.
Kick the tires and light the fires, Matt.
Got it.
No, but if you ever did kick one and the tire was really, really squishy and you hit your foot on the rim, that'd be a very bad sign. So that's an indication of a tire that is underinflated. So you want a little bit of squish at the bottom of the tire, but it shouldn't be so bowed out as to be obvious or to have any risk of the rim puncturing the tire on a landing or during the roll. You also want to check the tread depth and make sure that there is actual tread depth there, no flat spots, no visible cord showing, and make sure that there aren't any nicks or scrapes, slices out of the sidewall, because that could lead to a failure as well, and any fluids that might be leaking on them, and mainly in this case it would be brake fluid. The tires also have a modern general aviation tires also have a tube inside of them that's actually holding the air. So you're not going to be able to visually inspect that, but if the if the valve stem is at a really funky angle, that tube may have shifted inside that tire. Very, very strange circumstances for how that would happen. But if you do happen to see that, don't fly that aircraft. That's bound to fail. That's bound to pinch and cause a hole. And then you get a flat tire, normally on landing, and then you got to wait for them to come jack up the airplane and put it on a dolly or actually change the tire, and that's going to close down a runway for a little while. And you don't want to be that guy. But, yeah, I mean, that's a little bit of the modern gear, a little bit of modern tires.
Now, obviously, brakes, you know, I know there's some hydraulic brakes. There's other different types of brakes. So, historically, what have brakes looked like, even going back to, I mean, I guess the Wright Flyer didn't have any sort of brakes because they were skids. But, you know, going back in time, what have the different brake options been?
There's all kinds of stuff. I mean, from your tail skid, just planting it hard into the ground and using the drag from that to slow you down, to very simple methods of essentially like a drum brake system that was mechanical. So you were physically actually pressing onto the rotating axle or onto a wheel rim to slow it down. The Russians were very fond of pneumatic brakes. I think the British were also fond of pneumatic brakes as well. So basically the same style brake system like you have on your car, but instead of hydraulic fluid, they use pneumatics. And then you have the hydraulic braking system that, like on our Cessnas, is a single disc with two brake pads. To the more modern airliners, which are many discs and many pads, and then you have electronics that regulate the pressure that's applied to them to provide anti-skid, so you can get a lot of braking action right to the limit of what the surface and the conditions will give you without getting a lockup and damaging and blowing that tire. So, you know, the technology has come a long way. But we are getting a little sidetracked, I think, from landing gear, and we're talking about brakes here.
Well,
can you
I mean,
think
it's
of
all,
any other types of landing gear?
it's all kind of part of the same thing, right? I mean, the brakes around the gear. I think it's similar. Well, actually, so this leads me to another question, which is, we talk about tailwheel aircraft. There's the mains and then the tailwheel. And then in tricycle aircraft, there's the mains and the nose wheel. So what are the differences potentially between the mains you would see in a tricycle aircraft versus the mains you'd see in a tailwheel aircraft from a load standpoint, from the types of tires, or are they pretty much the same?
Pretty much the same. The main landing gear is the one you want to be putting the load on during landing. It should be the first thing to touch the ground. It should be the last thing to leave the ground on takeoff. So the only real difference in the mains between a tailwheel and a tricycle gear airplane is their positioning. So generally the tailwheel or conventional gear, the mains are forward of the center of gravity, and on a tricycle geared aircraft, the mains are aft of the center of gravity. The tricycle gear, like in the Cessnas and the Pipers, the main gear being behind the center of gravity actually leads to it being more stable in ground handling. So you think of that shopping cart wheel, it's always trailing behind its pivot point. Well, the center of gravity is your pivot point, and so your main gear, or the center of friction, and that is always trying to trail. It's not like the bad shopping cart wheel that's always wiggling back and forth, but it's just the opposite on a tailwheel airplane. The center of friction is in front of the center of gravity, and it's always trying to swap ends. It's always trying to get behind that pivot point. And so it's the pilot's job on takeoff, landing, and taxi to be very vigilant to try and keep those forces in balance so it doesn't swap ends on you. And that's called a ground loop.
The dreaded ground loop, which you always hear about when in tailwheel aircraft when you're learning how to fly those. And that's probably it's a lot of what you go through when you're getting, I guess, not your type rating, but just your endorsement for tailwheel.
Endorsement.
Right? Yep.
Yeah, I mean, we talk a lot about what the limits are, how far you can go, and generally don't let that tail get out beyond the width of the landing gear. Like, we still S-turn, and we still can maneuver and turn, but as soon as you let that get outside with any kind of momentum, it's going to be going around. And another place is crosswinds. You have to be really attentive to where the wind is coming from and make sure that you use good crosswind technique and maintain proper crosswind controls all throughout the landing, rollout, and the taxi so that the aircraft doesn't then decide to become a big old weather vane and point itself into the wind, especially if that's not where you want to be going.
So let's talk about struts. So we talk about the, I believe that's the right term, but when, I've always been told three fingers on the tricycle gear on the Cessna on the nose wheel. Like, what's that all about?
Olio strut. So that's a shock absorber, and it works by having a fluid-filled compartment and a compressed gas-filled compartment, and the separation between the two is going to be basically a metal plate with a very, very small hole in it. And that very small hole allows for the movement of fluid between the two chambers, but it only allows it to happen at such a rate. Now, hydraulic fluid and fluids in general are incompressible. So once you get into compression, that fluid is forced up against that hole, and now, since it can't compress, it has to squirt through that hole, and it provides resistance to the motion without providing a shock to the metallic attach points, because you can snap those if you don't have any kind of shock absorption. So that's how those operate, those shock absorbers. And that's the same way it operates on your car, on your off-road bikes, motorcycles, all that. It's all the same.
So then why, let's say, when I've done pre-flight in the past and with an instructor, and let's say it's 1 inch, sometimes the instructor will either lift from the prop or lift from the nose of the aircraft, say, oh, we can fix that. They lift it up, they let it go, and now it's three fingers. Like, what's happening there behind the scenes?
Yeah, so those two chambers, the pressure has potentially equalized due to a drastic change in temperature, or maybe you got a seal that's starting to go bad. And so if we see that less than three finger gap on the oleo strut, we can test by lifting up on the propeller, don't let it move, but lifting up on the propeller and letting that strut expand, and that will drain all the fluid back in. And then once you release all that lifting force and let it come back down, it will hopefully stay at that three-finger level. If not, we could have a variety of issues. I suppose simplest would be that a little bit of nitrogen or compressed air or whatever is in there on the gaseous side has leaked out. And so that's a semi-easy servicing. You connect it to the valve stem up at the top, and you squeeze a little more in there and get the proper inflation in it, and you can go fly. The other side of things could be a bad seal that has caused the hydraulic fluid to leak out, in which case you would lift up on that nose, the strut would expand, you would let go of it, and it would come back down, and it would just collapse all the way back down to the same spot or even lower. You would also typically see a puddle of red MIL-H5606 hydraulic fluid somewhere around that strut as well.
Why do the struts of a nose wheel on a Cessna need to be so complicated compared to a tailwheel aircraft, the third gear, right? Is it because there's less weight back there?
Yeah, absolutely. So on the tricycle gear airplane, you have to support the weight of the propeller, the engine, all the tubing, the firewall, everything that's up there. And so that may be 600-700 pounds, whereas on a tailwheel airplane, you may have 40-70 pounds back there. So you can get away with a leaf spring on the tailwheel because there's not nearly as much weight to have to support.
And what about an aircraft that was originally designed to be a tricycle aircraft and then converted to a tailwheel? I believe there was a Cessna model that converted was it a 206 or a 172 or 182, something like that, to a tailwheel aircraft?
Well,
you've mentioned it in the past.
Yeah, the original Cessna 120s, 140s, 150s, 170s, 180s, 185s, 175s, 190, 195, those were all tailwheel airplanes.
Wow.
But the Cessna 150/152, there was something called a Texas tailwheel conversion that could be done with that aircraft. And you hacked off the nose wheel. I'm oversimplifying this.
Yep. Don't try this at home.
Move the main gear forward. Yeah, don't get your welder out. You move the main gear forward, and then you installed a tailwheel on the back with some springs and cables up to the rudder pedal, or up to the rudder, so you had steering. And then you had a tailwheel airplane. You'd go back and forth on that Cessna 150 Texas tail dragger conversion. So it's for the most part, Cessna has some lineage in the tailwheel side. And like I said, things didn't really start transitioning to being tricycle gear until the 1950s, 1960s, when you had, after World War II, this big boom of former combat pilots who came back and bought airplanes and taught the next generation of pilots. Now you had the next generation of kind of Joe Schmoes who didn't have combat experience, combat training, military training, and the accident rate kind of spiked a little bit. So the manufacturers were like, whoa, people are ground looping and damaging their airplanes. We don't want our airplane to have a reputation as being unsafe, dangerous, or hard to handle. Let's make them tricycles and make them nice and easy, and that way we sell more because we don't get this bad reputation.
Interesting. Let's talk about retractable gear.
Sweet.
Yeah, I know you were going there. Let's talk about retractable gear. Actually, before we go to retractable gear, do we need to cover anything on floats? So floats, they're not really considered gear, right? I guess they're more like how would you
classify? Some have gear.
Okay. So there's,
yeah, if it's an amphibian. And you had different types of that. So you had flying boats, which had a bolt hull, and then you had landing gear that retracted up into that. If it was amphibious, mm-hmm. and you had pontoons on your aircraft, and if it was amphibious again, you would have landing gear that would extend and retract on that, or you had a pontoon aircraft. This is 1930s like racers, where they would just taxi up onto either onto shore, or they would taxi up onto a trailer just like a boat. But with the amphibious aircraft, you need to make sure that you have the gear up when landing on water and the gear down when landing on land. And it's an area where YouTube is full of videos of pilots who have done it the wrong way around for whatever reason, due to either distraction and attention, or they were used to one thing or the other, and they land on the water with the gear down, the thing flips over, or they land on the land with the gear up, and it just scrapes along, destroying their pontoons. It's like, ah, nuts, you hate to see it. Sure. And there's even a video of a CL, I think it's a CL-415, an air tanker, a water tanker, and they forgot to put the gear down, and these guys went scraping down the runway, and because it's a high-mounted engine airplane, they added the power and went around, but then they come back, and the damage to it is just horrendous. You know, so... got to make sure you put the gear down on land.
Were they able to extend the gear after that damage or no?
Yeah, because it didn't hurt the gear. It hurt the bottom of the boat hull.
Just the bottom of the hull.
The CL, yeah, the CL, I think it's the CL-415. It's a flying boat.
Yeah.
I'll look it up real quick here.
So moving on to retractable landing gear then. So obviously it sounds like retractable landing gear came out of a necessity of avoiding the drag that is inherent with three wheels just kind of hanging below you as you're flying. But I assume that retractable landing gear would have also added some weight to the aircraft. So where's that line drawn? Where do you figure out like where retractable landing gear is going to make a difference and it's worth having an aircraft with retractable landing gear?
That line is drawn by the engineer. Before he even puts a single rivet, turns a screw, or tightens a bolt, you know, they're making the designs for this thing, and they know how much it's going to weigh, how much power it's going to have, what the drag coefficient's going to be, what the power-to-weight ratio is going to be, what the performance is going to be out of all that. So math. Math is important for deciding about whether or not your aircraft is going to be retractable or whether it's going to be very... very streamlined gear. And in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, the way to go about it was to build a retractable gear aircraft. So you had your Beechcraft Bonanzas, you had your Moonies, Piper had all kinds of, they had the Aero, the Seneca series, all the multi-engine stuff. But even, that's the GA side, but even before that, post-World War One. And in the 1930s, you started to see retractable gear aircraft on the military aircraft. You know, GA wasn't as big back then, but the like Lockheed Vega, some of those civilian aircraft, and the Electra. I don't know if the Vega did, but the Electra had retractable gear. The Beech 17 Stagger Wing. I need to make sure I got that designation right because I keep thinking Beech 18, which is the twin Beech. So I'm just going to make sure. Yeah, Beech 17, the Stagger Wing had retractable gear. And all of that added weight, but it made the aircraft a little bit faster. And if you had the horsepower to make up for the extra weight, well, then it really didn't matter. However, our use of composites in the more modern era of aircraft design, since really the 1970s, late 70s, early 80s, and with composites becoming more and more prolific in the industry, now you could get these complex shapes, complex curves that were very aerodynamically clean, and because they were made out of composite materials, they were very, very light. So you didn't have the drag penalty anymore. You didn't have an excess weight penalty from having to put a retractable gear system on your aircraft, and you could actually make very, very fast airplanes for not a lot of horsepower. And that's where kind of the Cirrus borrows a lot of its design philosophy from as well. So they're using composites to make very clean aerodynamic shapes that get good performance that can keep up or even be faster than its competitor aircraft with retractable gear that had all the weight and maybe weren't made out of the composite materials. So, you know, you're sacrificing nothing to have an SR-20 go as fast as a Cessna 182 RG.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny. Like, I never really realized how much gear can actually add drag to the airplane until I was reading a historic incident in which there was a 747 that had its gear locked down, and it was over the ocean, and they couldn't retract the gear. And because of that, it cut their available distance by like 60% or something ridiculous like that. They had to land a lot sooner than they originally expected just because they could not retract their landing gear. And I don't know if that was there was probably a speed limitation at that point. I'm sure there's a gear down speed limitation. You probably would know that better than I do.
There's all kinds of extra V speeds that you need to learn once you start transitioning into complex aircraft, or at least aircraft with retractable gear. And I have to make that distinction nowadays, although anything that has retractable gear, I think, is going to be a complex aircraft. I digress. I had an issue a couple years ago in the Aero where we had an indication that the gear was not coming up, which is not the worst problem to have.
Is this the famous picture with the fire truck coming behind you?
No, that's a different story. Right. That's a different one. But we were in the Aero, and we weren't at the maintenance base. And we decided, well, it's fine to keep it down, and we'll just fly over to maintenance, and we'll get it looked at. And if it's a problem, you know, we'll get it fixed. And what it was a micro switch got stuck, and it wouldn't retract the gear. So, but we were moving the handle, but nothing was happening. You know, not the worst problem to have. Mm-hmm. But anyway... Yeah. But on the way there, we had to really watch our engine temperatures because we couldn't go very fast. And if we wanted to go any faster, we'd have to put more power to it. Well, that generates more heat. So we had to do this balance of managing the speed and the temperature of the engine. Because if that gets hot, now we're in a whole another world of hurt because we couldn't put the gear up. And that was a case where it was the middle of July and it was hot out and all kinds of stuff. So kind of got to watch your temperatures there. But the gear system on the Piper Aero is hydraulic. And the gear system on the Cessna 172RG is also hydraulic. But in the Aero, the pump runs one way. I'm sorry. In the Aero, the pump runs up and down, so it runs forward and backwards. And the RG, the pump runs, the 172 RG, the pump runs one way, but you're actually physically switching the lines, the hydraulic lines that the fluid flows through. So it's the difference between throwing an electrical switch and telling the pump to run one direction or the other, like in the Piper, or just switching the hydraulic lines. And then a pressure sensor sees a drop in pressure, and it goes, oh, I need to build that pressure up, and it turns the pump on itself. And that's all it's trying to do is build the pressure back up. But now that the gear can move, that hydraulic fluid is now extending or retracting the gear until they reach the limit of their travel, and the hydraulic pressure builds back again, and the pressure switch shuts off the pump.
Wow. The fact that you know all that off the top of your head.
You have to know these systems too. Like if I'm training someone in a complex aircraft, yep, we're going to go into detail on how every single one of those systems works and how, in the event of a loss of hydraulic or electrical power, how do you get that gear down, yep, in the event that you don't have the normal system to do it. So that you have to learn your emergency gear extension, and that extends from the Piper's free fall system, where it releases all the pressure, dumps it, and just allows the gear to come down. Or in the Cessna, you have to move the handle, and this is not the actual procedure, but you have to move the handle to the down position. Then you have to reach in between the front seats, extend the manual handle, and then pump it up and down 17 to 25 times.
Wow.
And actually physically build the pressure and pump the gear down. So in the Cessna system, the emergency gear extension actually has its own little separate hydraulic lines that are just for down. You get to pump them down. You cannot pump them up. But in the Beechcraft, the Beechcraft Bonanza and the Barons.
This is what you made the video for, right?
Yeah, last year, yeah. In the Beechcraft Bonanzas and Barons, those are electrical gear systems, electromechanical. And so in between, just behind the pilot and co-pilot seat, is an electric motor. And it's a rather complicated system, but very, very efficient, very high torque. It extends and retracts the gear. If that electrical system fails or the motor burns up, there's a little hand crank that you clear a little panel, and then you reach inside there and you crank this sucker, and it's a good amount of work, and it's like 50 cranks to get the gear down and locked. You can crank it down. You could also crank it up, but it's not recommended. But that's a whole lot of work that you have to do there in order to get that gear down. Some other aircraft use pressurized nitrogen, blowdown bottles. So if you lose hydraulics, you fire the blowdown bottles and it squirts nitrogen into the lines, and that moves whatever hydraulic fluid is in there to get that gear down.
Is there a cleanup after
B-17s.
That?
I have no idea what the reset of that system is like. Hmm. No clue. Hmm. B-17s, World War II, those were all manual cranks. And if you watch the movie Memphis Belle, spoiler alert, at the end they have to crank the gear down to land after their final mission. And it's kind of Hollywoodized, but the guys are cranking until they're exhausted and then switching out dudes. And the next guy cranks until he's exhausted, and then the next guy comes in. You know. So each aircraft and each different gear system, you need to know what your emergency gear extension is going to be for those.
And have you ever had the opportunity to test a manual extension on an aircraft?
I've done a couple in flight for training. We have ways of disabling the pumps by pulling circuit breakers for training in simulated emergencies. Mm-hmm. And then we'll give them a situation like, okay, go ahead, give me a power-off stall. And when they go to configure the aircraft and the landing configuration, which includes putting the gear down, and they run that GUMPS check, they move the switch, they wait for the green lights to come on. The green lights don't come on, and you're just CFI. You look over and go, what are you going to do? And they're looking at you like, what'd you do? And I'm like, figure it out, you know? So we do that quite a bit in training. And there was one time where I was in the Seneca, and we were coming in, I think we were doing the ILS. I can't remember if we were doing the ILS or if we were just doing normal pattern. It was at Hanscom, so we were like really far out because that happens there. Yeah. And noticed that we didn't have three green as I did the short final check. And I was pretty sure it was on when we first put the gear down. But when I did the short final check, make sure it's possible forward, three green, I go, and we got two green. And I did what every student does. I looked over at the instructor who was with me. He was doing my checkout, and I go, did you do that? He goes, nope. You go, cool, we're going around. So we do the go around, we climb back up, and we ran the checklist, which this is not an immediate action item issue. You know, we still got a perfectly good flying airplane. We climb back up, we run the checklist, we let Tower know what was going on, and we went, okay, and we circled over top of the airport, like 2,000 feet higher than pattern altitude or so, just the top of the airspace, and ran all the troubleshooting that we could, but we can't see the gear in the Seneca. It's a low-wing aircraft, so you can't see it.
Could the tower see it for you?
So we did a flyby of the tower, which is pretty cool because we were like 50 feet or 75 feet way over on the east ramp. So, like, yep. You know, we needed them to have a good look of it. And we went by and we rolled the aircraft left and right to if it was loose and dangling down there, they would be able to see it swinging, or they would see it fixed in place. And so we did that. But this was after we went back out to the practice area and we pulled a little bit of G on the aircraft to help the gear come down. Okay. Just hoping that, hey, maybe it's just kind of stuck up there and whatever. And then we came back around, did the wing wag by the tower. We made another approach, just kind of simulating that we were going to land, making sure that we understood how the airplane was going to handle. We went around, came back in. And then the last one, we landed and shut down on the runway. Because of this whole ordeal, we had declared the emergency. And on the last landing, the fire trucks were already staged and waiting for us. We got the aircraft stopped, motors were shut down, we opened the doors, got out, looked underneath, and saw that the down locks were engaged. And what had happened was inside of the insulation for the gear down lock micro switch that tells you, that turns on that light inside, the wire had frayed inside the insulation. So it wasn't even something that you would see during a pre-flight or a visual inspection. Because it sits out there in the airstream and it gets kind of beat up on. And it was a 50-year-old airplane, 40-year-old airplane.
And that's not something you you would have noticed until after maintenance looked at it, right? Then you probably found out later.
Yeah, so they do their diagnostics once we get back, and they start tracing it from, you know, the micro switch. Well, actually, they would probably look at the light bulb first. We already did that in flight because the three lights, you can swap them out. They're all the same light. Mm-hmm. So you could take it apart, change the light bulb, put it back in, see if it comes on. No, it still didn't come on. That was part of the thing that we did. So they start there, then they go back to the micro switch, test the micro switch, and put a meter on it and look at the wire. And, hey, we got no connectivity from here to there. So, okay, the wire's probably bad. Change the wire out. Boom. Airplane's back in service.
Wow. That's awesome. Like, I mean, obviously, I'm glad you guys were safe. Obviously, that's number one, but what an interesting story.
Yeah, and I mean, and we used every available resource, too. We used what was in the checklist. We used our knowledge of mechanical systems. We had Tower call our maintenance and talk to them on the phone, and he came back with some suggestions. We're like, yeah, we did that. Yeah, we did that. Yeah, we did that. No, we didn't do that one yet. Okay, we'll go do that. And once we exhausted every possible means of trying to get that gear down or verifying, making sure that it was down and locked and we weren't about to make a whole bunch of sparks going down the runway, then we came in for the landing attempts. And there was even some discussion there about, hey, do you want to gear up, gear down? Do you want to try and do it in the grass? Do you want to do it on the asphalt? And, I mean, no matter what, your best option is to try and put it on the asphalt, whether you're gear up or gear down. Put it on the asphalt. The risk of fire in general aviation airplanes is extremely low. So if you're having any kind of gear issue, don't put it in the grass. Put it on the asphalt. Asphalt is smooth compared to grass and dirt and stuff.
Got it.
If it was a golf course, maybe. Maybe I'd consider the grass. But I don't know. I've golfed on some golf courses. I'm no expert. And there's a lot of divots out there. I'm not saying they could topple an airplane, but you know, they're not. They're the best manicured hilly areas, yeah. And that's the problem is you have changes in elevation, whereas on asphalt it's all the same level.
Oh, interesting. That makes a lot of sense. I would never thought of that. I would have thought that maybe if you got to be gear up and you've got a good grass place to go, that might be safer. But that's, you make a really good point that even if it's going to cause some sparks, it's reliably flat and consistent.
Yep, 100%.
Rob, when you were deciding, and this is actually something I was going to ask you, and I think you answered partially, but when you were figuring all that out, you were looking at, going out to the practice area, pulling some Gs, switching out all the light bulbs, all these things that you did. You said that some of that was on the checklist, some of that wasn't. It's interesting that you said you called the tower and you had tower call maintenance, but a lot of that came from experience as well, or did you, like, how much of that came from calling other people and saying, hey, we need ideas? Because I as somebody who doesn't have that many hours and is still a student, but I'm sure many of our listeners are kind of in between me and you in regards to hours, you know, if they found themselves in that situation, they might run the checklist. They might say, okay, well, let me try this light bulb thing. But after that, they might be out of ideas. So what are ways that they can, you know, have more ideas before they put themselves in a situation where they're taking a risk?
Yeah, use all available resources. And if you're the only person in the cockpit, you need to understand that you're limited to your own knowledge and own experience. And when this particular incident happened, we had two very experienced pilots on board. The instructor had already had a stint at the airlines and had flown King Airs for Medevac and had been flying that aircraft in particular for a while. We were both aerobatic guys. Like, we were basically two of the same people, but he had thousands more hours than me, and I had probably 5,000 at the time already. I learned a lot by listening to other pilots and hearing stories and reading accident reports and reading reports from other pilots. And that kind of helps to paint a picture. And the most important stories I think I can relate, or the most important part of this story really, is that neither one of us in the cockpit stopped working the problem and stopped sharing with the other person or stopped sharing with ATC. You know, we did use all available resources to the extent of, hey, call this person who their expertise is maintenance. My expertise is on flying the airplane. Okay. So, all right. Maybe I'm limited. Maybe there's something I don't know, and this maintenance expert will know, and I can try that. And so if you're by yourself, use all available resources to include the person sitting next to you. Maybe you're not by yourself. Maybe you're with a loved one who's not a pilot. Can they read English? Hand them a checklist and be like, hey, you see that number one? Start there. Read down this way, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And it gives them something to do, okay? Reassure them, hey, yeah, we're going to be fine. We have something to deal with right now. If you wouldn't mind helping me, this would be great. You know, so those kind of things, I think, come up with ways to deal with the problem. But number one, do you remember the number one rule?
Aviate.
Yep, fly the airplane. Fly the airplane. So... there's a great podcast on, I think it's AOPA Live or AOPA, and oh, I'm losing the name of it right now, but it's really, really good. Hold on.
Well, while you're while you're thinking about the podcast,
no. Oh, okay, I got it. Okay, I got it. It's okay. AOPA. There I was, and it's stories from pilots who have had issues, problems, emergencies, and they talk about their experience, how they got through it, what they did, and what they learned from it. And so don't shy away from these learning opportunities when these things happen. There's all kinds of stories out there from pilots who had issues and got through it.
Well, it's funny, Rob. Like, you know, even now where I'm not anywhere near close to flying an aircraft that has retractable landing gear, you know, you have hammered gumps into my head. And, you know, that second letter, undercarriage, you know, checking to make sure you have a wheel. I have a wheel. You have a wheel. I mean, the chances of not having a wheel on a, I mean, I guess actually based on some stories we've heard in the past from that student that lost a wheel on takeoff in the Cessna. But, you know, I the chances of not having wheels
Piper.
In a fixed gear aircraft.
It was
aircraft,
a Piper.
Oh, it was a Piper. Okay.
Yeah. And they only knew because when they were coming in to land, an aircraft holding short called them on the radio and was like, you need to go around. Your gear fell off. Your wheel fell off. Or no, they had just taken off. And the airplane that was behind them holding short said, hey, their wheel just fell off. But anyway, yeah, Piper, low wings, you can't see it.
Interesting. Okay, yep, that makes sense. But it's just like you hammer that undercarriage in so that when you actually end up going to fly a retractable gear aircraft, you've got that Gumps check hammered in your head and you're going to be checking for that gear and it may just save you from forgetting to put the gear down one day because you've been doing that since you were learning, you know, you were a 50-hour student versus a, you know, 500, 600,000-hour retractable gear pilot, complex aircraft pilot.
Yeah, and even that Gumps check, that undercarriage check, gets done when we're doing maneuvers as well because it's not check the gear is down, it's check that the gear is appropriate. So, like the amphibious aircraft example, if you're landing on water, you get to undercarriage and you got to go, water, gear, up. Land, gear, down. You know, it's is that appropriate?
That
so
makes a lot of sense.
Gas, gauges, undercarriage, mixture, power, and all of those are, as appropriate, as necessary. Because power could be wide open throttle. But if you're getting ready for a power-off stall, that doesn't make any sense.
That's why you yell at me all the time when I say power, check.
Like, or in the green.
Like, yeah.
In the green doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
You know, is that appropriate? Is that where it's supposed to be?
Yep.
Or no, power good. Yeah. Good. In the green, I'm okay with on like gauges, but like people saying, gauge is good. What does that mean? Are they where they're supposed to be? Is that?
I'm going to leave you with one more question that's coming from my head, and then we'll run a checklist to make sure we've covered all aspects of gear before.
Oh, you think I'm done talking about gear? All right, keep going.
Before moving on to online questions, because we got, you know, we might have to have a gear part two. But my thing is actually, it's really funny that they call it landing gear, considering you also use it on takeoff. Huh? All right, so we've covered tailwheel aircraft, we've covered tricycle aircraft, we've covered struts, we've covered brakes, we've covered like pretty much with amphibs. Like anything else, retractable landing gear, complex, anything else you want to talk about with regards to gear before we move on to online questions, which will be related to gear, but I want to make sure there's nothing else that you've got in your brain first before we move on.
Wheel pants.
What?
Wheel pants.
What about wheel pants?
So wheel pants are coverings that go around the tires and the brakes. That's a very high drag area.
You see those
on some
aircraft.
So you put these aerodynamic shapes. Yeah, you put these aerodynamic shapes on there to smooth that airflow so you don't get as much parasite drag from the gear. The Cirruses have very good wheel pants that are very, very low down, so there's only just a little bit of that tire sticking out. And that can be a problem if you get a flat tire. You have to take those wheel pants off. Generally, you're going to have to take them off anyway. But the Cirrus also has another different method for steering than we're used to in the Cessnas and the Pipers. They have a castering nose wheel, whereas we're used to in the Cessna having a steerable nose wheel. So you press on the right rudder, some tension goes on a bungee, and it pulls on a lever arm, and that twists the nose wheel. In the Cirrus, you have to steer by differential braking. So long taxis with a direct strong crosswind, you may be heating up those brakes and getting them real, 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 real hot. And so you need a temperature indicator to make sure that you don't overheat those brakes. But that nose wheel also, that castering nose wheel also makes it very, very maneuverable, almost like a tailwheel aircraft where it can pivot pretty much in its own radius. It's a rather interesting way to get a very thin piece of tubular spring steel and very light mechanism out on the nose of the airplane, and you cover it with a wheel pant. And it's real aerodynamic, very light, and helps you go fast.
Got it. All right. Interesting. I always wonder what those were called.
Oh, yeah. Wheel pants, wheel fairings. But the wheel pants also have an opening on the bottom. Like, the tire's got to come out somewhere, right?
Yep.
So what some of the smarter engineers figured out was, well, there's pressure up inside there. And so we need to cut a relief in the side and the back of this wheel pant to relieve that pressure and help vacate some of that air. And I think it's on the brand new Extra NG has a neat opening on the back of the wheel pants that reduces drag again to help make those wheel pants as aerodynamically neutral as possible, which is amazing. Really smart engineers figured this stuff out.
Wow, that's awesome. Well, you learned something.
I think
something
now
new every day.
I'm done.
Now you're done? All right. So let's go into a couple questions. First, how do aircraft steer on the ground? And I think for most of our listeners, they've got a general gist of this, but I'll give you a hint. Let's talk about tiller versus rudder pedals.
So you're now making me reach back into my brain to 2007's Systems 2 college class where they talked about the Embraer 145, and I'm going to get all the numbers wrong, but with ground steering, you would have like 5 or 12 degrees of nose travel, of steering travel with the rudder pedals, but once you activated the tiller, then you could get another like 35, 40 degrees or something like that of steering angle. The problem with the tiller on the 145 was that it wasn't active unless you pushed it down and held it down the entire time you were steering it. And if you released that downward pressure, it would automatically and as quickly as it could hydraulically turn that nose wheel back into the steering limit for the rudder pedals alone. So if you were at like full lock, 40 degrees or whatever it is for the Embraer 145, and you accidentally release that pressure, it would snap itself back to like 5 degrees and jolt the aircraft around. So, like, that's not good. On the F-18 and the F-14, let's talk about the F-18 for a second. The aircraft carrier deck is a very, very narrow area. It's a very confined space. And so you need to be able to get that aircraft to pivot as much as you can. So they have nose wheel steering that is not on by default, has to be activated by a button on the side of the flight stick, and it has a couple different modes, but you turn it on in the first mode and you get kind of low sense, and you get like 15 degrees or so of limited steering travel, and then you click it or hold it depending on what mode you're in, and then you get high sense and it goes to like 80 degrees of travel.
Oh wow.
So you can steer the thing around.
Now, what are you steering there, with your feet or with your arm?
Yeah, it's with your feet.
Oh, with feet. Okay.
No, it's with your feet.
Yeah.
Yep, so it's rudders. And it's a very powerful system that allows you to get some really good maneuverability in a confined area. But activating it at the wrong time at high speeds would be bad and possibly tip the jet over. So that's no good.
Don't try this at home.
Oh, I remember there was one more thing. Trailing link gear. Since we're talking about the F-18, there's a bunch of different gear types out there, from bungees, mostly on tricycle gear, tubular spring steel on the Cessnas, oleo struts, which we talked about on the nose wheel of the Cessna, are the main gear and the nose wheels of most Pipers. And then you have trailing link gear, where it's basically like an L shape, but or like a triangle, whereas the hypotenuse of the triangle is a shock absorber, and that allows you to geometrically get a whole bunch of travel out of that landing gear, and all of that travel is eaten up by a shock absorber, so you can take very hard hits, very high loads, and not damage the equipment, not damage the aircraft. And you see this a lot on the F-18. You see trailing link gear, because what's their mission? Their mission is to smack the thing into a carrier deck. So you got to have a lightweight, robust system that's capable of taking a hit. And that's what you'll see on that aircraft. And you'll even see that on the PC-12. The Pilatus PC-12 has trailing link gear and is very, very smooth on the landings.
Oh, interesting.
Okay, now I think I'm done about gear.
So going back to...
If I missed any gear types, send us a message.
Hello
at Spread Aviation.
So we were talking about the tiller, which is, in my mind, kind of like a steering wheel, right? That's as close to a steering wheel as you're going to get.
Yeah, pretty much.
But,
unless you fly something from the 1930s, yeah.
Well, what was from the 1930s?
Oh, they were literally putting wheels in them on where the yoke was.
Oh, interesting.
You still had pitch. You still had elevator forward and back, yep. But it was a big old wheel.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. I'll have to see one of those. So then there's a lot of aircraft that you steer on the ground and you control the nose wheel with rudder pedals. And sometimes it's powered by the rudder itself, and sometimes it's powered by pressure on the wheel. And a lot of that is indicative of like airspeed, because obviously the rudder has to have authority. Where do they draw the line on that? How big do the controls have to be? Like, that seems to be a lot different. And I mean, this is getting a little bit away from landing gear, but you know, on something like the Decathlon or the Extra, where there's a lot larger of a rudder, right?
Yeah.
Wouldn't it would probably have more authority on the ground at lower airspeeds than like a Cessna 172 would. So can you talk a little bit about that and steering on the ground, steering the gear on the ground, and why some aircraft need that pressure to push left or push right versus some aircraft that can just, you know, yaw right, yaw left on the ground based on rudder authority alone?
Yeah, I mean, anytime you're changing direction, you need some kind of force acting on you. And in tailwheel airplanes, the tail surfaces are bigger than on tricycle-geared aircraft, because you need to have control authority at stall speed, because they're designed, tailwheel airplanes are designed to land a three-point full stall attitude, so you need to have big tail feathers. Mm. The Decathlon specifically had the same size, if not slightly bigger, elevator and rudder than the 172, but it was also 700 to 800 pounds lighter. Mm-hmm. So you got a whole lot of authority out of that same size control surface, because you didn't have as much mass to move around. Now, the aircraft that are probably the biggest hazard or the biggest handful that pilots have the hardest time with are the pit specials, because they kind of have a little bit narrow gear, a little bit short track between the tailwheel and the main gear, and there's an aerodynamic, and some of them do not even have steerable tail wheels. So there's an aerodynamic limit to how effective that rudder can be. So as you get down through 40, 30 miles an hour, the rudder is no longer effective and the tailwheel isn't steerable. So that it was like this no man's land where you have to make sure that you were absolutely straight with no forces acting on that aircraft before you can apply any kind of corrective steering with the brakes. And the brakes can be very sensitive. And in a tailwheel airplane, you don't want to use a whole lot of brake while you have a whole lot of energy, because now you're a teeter-totter and you go flipping up over the nose and you end up upside down. So the Pitts has had this reputation as being squirrely. And Curtis Pitts said there's no such thing as a squirrely airplane, only squirrely pilots. And keeping that in mind, if you have it straight and you keep it straight, it will stay straight. Is that a kitty?
What, in the background?
Did I see kitty ears?
Yeah, that's Mousy.
Oh, Mousy is there?
Of course she is. She's not starving in Boston.
Okay, good. That will put Hillary's mind at ease.
As you've been asking that question every day. Where's Mousers?
We almost went to your apartment today and kidnapped him. So
her. So okay, forgetting tailwheel aircraft for a second. One final question on this before we move on to our second online question. Tricycle aircraft. Are there any of them where you turn on the ground simply by either rudder authority or differential braking only, and there's no pressure on the nose wheel when you apply rudder right or left? Because I know like a lot of like
the Cirrus.
Cirruses, got it.
Yeah, the Cirrus are one example. I believe Diamonds are the other.
And it is
the DA-20s, 40s, 42s.
And is that by rudder authority or differential braking or yes?
Yes, it's rudder authority and differential braking. So if you're fast enough that the rudder has any kind of authority, then yeah. Otherwise, it's got to be differential braking.
Interesting. All right. Well, lots and lots about gear and turning on the ground, et cetera, et cetera. Very, very informative today. Second question. Why does the 737 not have gear door covers? Or
don't need
gear
it.
Doors?
Yeah, don't need it. So it's not a big enough cavity to where you're getting any kind of parasite drag, or the amount of parasite drag is negligible. And it's the same on the Piper Aero, the Piper Seneca, the Piper Seminole. You have a hubcap, and that's taking care of the biggest cavity, which is the hub of the wheel.
Oh, interesting.
And so it's essentially, as far as the air is concerned, at the speeds that they're traveling, the air can't make the corner to get up into that cavity anyway. So as long as you fill it in like 80%, you're eliminating the majority of the drag, and you don't need the extra weight of a gear door or the extra complexity that it would take to get that gear door out of the way of the gear once it was down. It's like the P-51 Mustang has two doors. One part of the door is actually attached to the gear leg and moves down and outboard with the gear, and the other part is a door that moves down and inboard when the gear comes down. And then once the gear gets to its down and lock position, that inboard door closes back up again. So if you ever see, and that's all hydraulic. So if you see a P-51 parked on a ramp anywhere that's been sitting there for a while, those inner gear doors will be down, but once they start cranking the motor and the hydraulic pump starts turning, those gear doors will close and collapse as the engine starts.
So why don't all aircraft manufacturers just get rid of gear doors?
Well, like Cessna doesn't have any in the tail. They do have them in the nose. Bonanzas have them in the nose. I don't believe that the Bonanzas also behave very similarly to the P-51, but it's all mechanical. Mm-hmm. So there's two gear doors there as well, one on the strut, one that goes down the other inboard, mm-hmm. and then it closes back up. And it's super neat how that system works. A bunch of over-center cams and things like that. It's neat.
Can you put it into words for us?
No. It turns linear motion into rotational motion into linear motion in very unique and fascinating ways. It's very, 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 very awesome. And that's not even talking about the V-tail and its mechanism. But really, it comes down to weight, cost, complexity, and liability. So why are they not making new GA retractable gear airplanes? Because when a pilot forgets to put that gear down, the insurance company has to pay. So who's going to get, who's the insurance company going to go after to get that money back? Are they going to go after the one with the deep pockets and the owner? And that's the manufacturer. So if you build it in a way that could be used incorrectly on purpose or on accident, the insurance companies are going to get you. And so the liability, the manufacturers don't want to take it. That's why Cessnas, Piper, all these folks are getting away from retractable gear aircraft.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know
it's
that.
It's a liability. Yeah, and so the FAA is even has even modified training requirements for complex training, which used to have to be done in an aircraft. You had to use 10 hours, have to do 10 hours in an aircraft with retractable gear, controllable pitch propeller, and movable flaps. Well, now you can do 10 hours in a technically advanced aircraft, which moving map, GPS, autopilot, and that counts. That's counting now for complex experience.
Wait, in a
the world is changing.
In like a G1000 is considered.
Yeah, is
complex?
Technically advanced aircraft. Not complex.
Not complex.
The
just
complex
advanced.
Definition didn't change.
Okay.
Yeah, it's technically advanced. So the complex definition didn't change, but the regulatory requirements for flight of an actual complex aircraft has changed dramatically in the last 5 years.
Interesting. Interesting. Like, I'm surprised that there's...
People couldn't remember to put the gear down.
Yeah, so I guess that leads me to my next question is, as we've improved technology in all these aircraft, you know, why can't there just be a big buzzer when you're 50 feet AGL that alerts you if the gear's not down?
There is.
Oh.
There's on the Cessna 172 and the Piper Aero, there's two gear warnings. One, if you pull the throttle back below 12 inches of manifold pressure,
okay.
12 or 14, depending on. If you pull it back, there's a buzzer that goes off.
Okay.
And it's right in your headset, as well as the aircraft airframe speaker, so the cockpit speaker, goes off there. And if you have the flaps down more than the second notch, there's a buzzer, and the gear's not down, there's a buzzer that goes off. There were systems back in the 1930s, 40s, 50s. If the gear wasn't down and the power was retarded to kind of an off condition, it was basically a piece of rubber on a motor, and it would whack the pilot's feet. That was their gear warning.
Wow.
Just this thing going on your foot.
Oh, wow.
Hey, put the gear down, dummy. Now you have on the airliners gear not down, gear not down, landing gear, landing. You have all kinds of warnings, visual,
and people
audible.
Still forget.
People still forget. So you get. I have never geared up an airplane, but I have geared up a sim. That was me knocking on wood. But I have geared up a sim. I was at Kent. I was doing a currency flight in an ATD. My buddy Tyler was doing the operation of the sim, and he gave me an engine failure over top of the airport, like 3,000 AGL. And I was all confident and cocky. I was like, oh, I got this. And I best glide, started my spiral, and I'm going through all these turns. I'm like, yeah, got this field made. No problem. Get to the key position, turn base to final. I'm in the roundout. I'm flaring, and the thing is settling down to the runway. And I'm like, man, this thing looks lower than it normally. And Tyler starts howling. He's laughing his
Ooh.
Butt off. He's like, you didn't put the gear down. And it was at that moment that it started scraping along that I heard the bah, 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 bah. It had been going off the entire time, the entire 3,000-foot AGL spiral down. Just bah, 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 bah. The most annoying, glaring warning you could imagine. And I went auditory deaf to it. I tuned,
you tuned it,
it out.
Out? Now, were you? Do mm-hmm. you think your brain was not, just assuming... Not, assuming that because there was the engine out, there were a bunch of alerts, so they just all blended into one another, or
I should have what the technical term for this is, but
is it alert fatigue? Because there's actually something
like that. Yeah.
There's actually something in
it's
technology
like
called alert fatigue, right? Like where you know we get so many alerts or so many different things that at some point you just start ignoring them or they start blending into one another and you miss the important stuff. It's you know, there's,
yeah. That's why my wife is upset at me for having 17,000 unread emails that pop up on my phone. She's like, why don't you get rid of those? I'm like, I just don't care. But yeah, I mean, it's that alert fatigue. I'm looking up now, alarm fatigue.
Alarm fatigue. Actually, if you Google alarm fatigue, I think one of the results is a BitLancer blog post on alarm fatigue. There's so much overlap between aviation and technology. It's insane.
More than likely.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that it's every video that I've ever seen of an accidental gear up. It's usually two pilots up in the front, filmed by a backseater, at least the one I'm thinking of. And you can hear in the video the alarm going off. Bap, 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 bap. And they're just motoring towards the runway. Do-do-do-do-do. Round out, flare, skid, slide. And at one point, like, I think in the one video, the pilot looks at him and goes, forgot to put the gear down. They're still sliding. He's like, forgot to put the gear down.
Well, you're not going
to
go around at that point. The damage is done.
No. No, you're done for. Except you see that the Piper... I've lost the name of it. Fastest Piper Twin. The Aerostar. There's a video of an Aerostar down in Florida that does a touch and go with the gear up. It scrapes along the runway, adds the power, gets it back airborne again, and goes and lands at some other airport and just leaves. And the follow-up to that story was it was like a week later found a posting for sale Piper Aerostar needs props and engine.
Ooh. You probably need a NASA form that, right, if you land.
Oh, yeah. and if you went around.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a real bad idea. Like, that guy got very, 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 very lucky to have survived that.
All right. Well, we're coming up close on 30 minutes on this episode, so we need to get to our final.
No,
question.
We're well over an hour.
I know. Final question, Rob, and I know the answer to this, so I'm setting you up here. Is why do aircraft sometimes shake as soon as they leave the runway?
Oh, it's the tires. Mm-hmm. Tires are still spinning. They're coming down. They're slowing down, so you feel that vibration.
So what do you do to counteract that?
Well, they tap the brakes.
Yep.
Tap the brakes, get them stopped, then you start your retraction. So you want to get that rotating mass stopped before you go for the retraction because of gyroscopic precession. And gyroscopic precession dictates that any force applied acts on 90 degrees in the direction of rotation. And so with your gear system, you're swinging it one way, but gyroscopic precession is torquing it in a way that it's not supposed to go, or it's not designed to go, and that can wear out your bearings, break things, all kinds of bad, jam your gear in the up position. So you want to make sure you get those wheels stopped and then go for your retraction.
Rob, anything else on landing gear you want to talk about, or gear in general? Not just landing, takeoff gear as well.
Take care of it. Pre-flight it. Like, your life depends on it. You know, look for problems with the gear. On the 172RG, there were a dozen places on the gear trundle that we were looking for cracks. And we did have an issue at Kent where one cracked and it failed to retract, thank goodness. So they had it down and they came back and landed. And what we found was a crack in the pinion. And it was not, or in the ring and pinion, there was a crack in the ring, and it was not going to engage because it was jammed. And then I had another issue where on the 172RG, in flight, hydraulic pressure holds the gear up. So there's no locks. It's just hydraulic pressure. And over time, that pressure will bleed off a little bit. The pressure switch will go, oh, we're below 1,200 PSI, vip, and it'll run that quick to go from 1,200 to 1,500 PSI and charge that system back up. There was one day I took off with a student. We put the gear up. We turned crosswind. I heard the gear motor just whoop. That's weird. Halfway across the downwind, whoop. That shouldn't be doing that frequently. Like, it normally it's like a 15, 20, 30-minute thing, and here it was doing it every minute and a half, something like that. And so we put the gear down, came back and landed, and when we got the aircraft parked, I stuck my head up underneath the dash, and it was covered in hydraulic fluid. There was a pinhole leak behind the dash that was just spraying MIL H 5606 all up on the backside of this thing. So if that was allowed to continue, it would have eventually pumped out all of the fluid had we not been paying attention to that little gear motor coming on.
Interesting. Good lesson.
Then we would have had emergency pump the gear down.
Good lesson. You know, it's funny. I've been sitting on a bunch of Instagram lives recently and listening to some podcasts, and I realized that I'm not the only one that finds it weird when somebody tells a really like beneficial, heartwarming story like you just did, and educational story. It's like, it's kind of like looking at the Grand Canyon, right? It's like you look at it and you say, this is magnificent, but you really can't put in a response in good words. And that kind of happens to me sometimes when you go off for 5 or 10 minutes and discuss something. It's valuable. And at the end, I feel so weird just saying, cool, or okay, thanks, that's great. And I feel like I have to say something more magnificent than that. Like, that was a superb
that
story, Rob.
Me,
much thank you. You know, many thanks. And I just, you know, it's good to know that other
much thanks. We're good.
Thanks. Yeah, it's good to know that I can just kind of say cool, and everybody else does that too, and it's okay, it's acceptable, it's good. All right, take us home.
Okay, we said all the contact stuff at the beginning, so this one's easy. Fly safe.
Bye.